Welcome to Come and Reason with Christian psychiatrist and author Dr. Tim Jennings. Together we will reason through complex issues to find evidence-based answers that harmonize scripture, science, and our life experiences. I'm your Come and Reason host, Charles Mills. This program is sponsored by Come and Reason Ministries. Hello, everyone. There's a Bible text that kind of says it all when it comes to Satan's way of leading us far from the safe, protecting arms of Jesus. It's Proverbs 14:12, and it reads, "There's a way that seems right to a man, but in the end, it leads to death." What exactly is that way? How can we tell if we're on it? For the next two programs, Dr. Jennings will share the words he wrote in his groundbreaking book, Could It Be This Simple? A Biblical Model for Healing the Mind. The chapter on which we'll be focusing, it's called The Way of Death. Let's listen.
As we have repeatedly discovered, the problem with sin is that it destroys. Violations of God's law of love and liberty naturally result in damage to our ability to reason and think. We lose the ability to discern what is healthy from the unhealthy, what is right from wrong. When we choose destructive behavior, we gradually weaken the conscience so that it is no longer sensitive to the breaking of God's law of love and liberty. Losing our moral bearing, we become like unthinking animals driven by passion and lust. If we persist in rebellion, we become so damaged that no amount of truth will make an impact because sin has irrevocably destroyed the faculties of reason and conscience. Satan's goal is to destroy our higher mental faculties, dethrone reason, distort or destroy conscience, and control the will with the passions and feelings. It is the way of death. When the faculties of the mind that respond to truth have perished, God can no longer do anything to save us. We are beyond his reach, and he will sadly let us go to reap the consequences of our choices. He lets us follow the path of death. Christ said, "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." John 8:32. But having no truth of his own, Satan does everything in his power to prevent God's truth from reaching our understanding. He does this in several ways. First, he attempts to destroy reason and conscience, because it is through them alone that truth enters the mind. Without reason and conscience, we are incapable of understanding truth and are therefore helpless in our fight for freedom. One of the methods Satan uses to destroy reason is to convince people to believe things that are antithetical and that don't make sense. To achieve his goal, he influences them to disregard their reason so that they accept two things that cannot be true at the same time. For example, Satan counters the truth that God is love by encouraging us to believe that he chooses who will be saved and who will be lost, insisting that we have no free choice in the matter. As we have previously seen, love cannot exist without freedom. Therefore, the two beliefs are mutually exclusive. Both cannot be true at the same time, and the only way to believe both is to surrender reason. In such situations, we rationalize the contradiction by saying, "I take that on faith," which, as we have seen, isn't faith at all. A youth pastor did his best to depict the wonders of heaven as he conducted a weekend seminar. He gave a glorious description of the unimaginable delights awaiting us in heaven and God's never-ending love for us. Then, in sudden contrast, he displayed a marshmallow man suspended from a string. As he set the marshmallow man afire, the youth pastor described in horrible detail the pain and suffering God would inflict on all those who refused to be saved. He told the young people that the Lord has gone to enormous lengths to demonstrate his love for us, but if we refuse to surrender our lives to him, he will be forced to torture and destroy. But the youth minister's demonstration presents an antithetical belief. If we utilize our reason, we would realize that God cannot be the loving father and the threatening destroyer at the same time. If he dealt with us through intimidating methods, then our response to him would be coerced rather than freely given. Such a relationship cannot be true because it violates God's law of liberty and will result in rebellion. One can believe the youth minister's position only by dethroning reason. If God is not threatening to destroy the unrepentant, then what will he do to those who reject him? It is very simple, really. He takes the only loving action he can. He lets them go, and when the life giver lets go, they die. Consider a husband who comes home from work and is devastated when his wife tells him that she is leaving him for another man. How might he respond? What if he grabbed her, dragged her to the basement, handcuffed her to the wall, put a gun to her head and said, "All I want is your love. But if you refuse to love me, I'll be forced, by my love, to kill you." How would she react? Would she feel greater love or greater desire to get away? Such treatment clearly violates the law of liberty and results in greater rebellion, not greater love. Since the husband cannot win his wife with such tactics, what can he do? Ask her to stay? He can demonstrate his love for her in actions and deeds. He can even have an envoy go to his wife and try to convince her to stay. But if, after all his efforts, she insists on leaving him, what's the only loving and just route that he can take? Let her go. If we insist on leaving God, despite all his efforts to win us back, the only loving and just thing he can do is release us. And when the life giver does that, we die. God's letting go, his giving us up to reap the consequence of our choice, is what the Bible refers to as his wrath. In Romans chapter 1, Paul states three times, verses 24, 26, and 28, that God's wrath is giving them up. When I first considered this possibility, it was very difficult for me to accept because I had been taught my entire life that God would one day use his power to punish and destroy. The flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, the deaths of the firstborn in Egypt, and many other such stories in the Old Testament supported the idea that God would punish. The popular doctrine of eternal hell teaches that God will punish forever. But what I didn't understand then was what God actually said to Adam and Eve. If you eat of the fruit of the tree in the middle of the garden, you will die. Genesis 2:17. In other words, he said, should you disobey, your actions will so change you that it will result in your death. If you insist on leaving me, I will let you go. And since I am the source of your life, when you separate from me, you will perish. The natural consequence of violating my law of love and liberty is self-destruction. I had also forgotten that only one person in all history has died the death God told Adam and Eve about, the death that is the wages of sin and that results from separation from God, the sinner's death. All the examples I had previously used to understand this, the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah, the firstborn of Egypt, didn't apply, because every one of those people will one day be resurrected, either in the resurrection of life or that of damnation. Matthew 5:28 and 29, Revelation 20:4 through 6. I had to look at the cross and discover what had happened to Christ. I had to see how God treated the one who became sin, though he knew no sin, 2 Corinthians 5:21. On the cross, God treated his son as an unrepentant, unhealable sinner. Christ took the sinner's place on the cross and experienced from the Father what the unrepentant will ultimately endure in the final judgment. And what did God do to his son at the cross? What did Christ plead? My God, why are you torturing me, beating me, raining fire down from heaven on me? No. My God, why have you forsaken me, abandoned me, given me up? Matthew 27:46 and Romans 4:25. The evidence supports, and it is extremely reasonable to believe, that a loving God will release those who freely choose to separate from him. He allows them to leave because they have persisted in rebellion so long that they are beyond healing. Through refusing to use the faculties that respond to truth, they have destroyed themselves. They are not the victims of an angry and vengeful God who wants to torture them for all eternity. Satan is such a convincing liar that he has perpetrated a mass fraud on most of Christianity about this issue. Isaiah 33:14 tells us that the sinners in Zion are terrified, trembling grips the godless. Who of us can dwell with the consuming fire? Who of us can dwell with the everlasting burning? Many Christians conclude that this passage has hell in mind. But who does the Bible say will actually dwell there? The next verse, Isaiah 33:15, answers the question. He who walks righteously and speaks what is right, who rejects gain from extortion and keeps his hand from accepting bribes, who stops his ears against plots of murder and shuts his eyes against contemplating evil. Should we simply approach this passage on faith? God said it, I believe it, that settles it. or should we ask some questions? If we take the Bible as a whole, starting in Genesis and searching all the way through, we discover something most interesting. In Exodus 3, when God spoke to Moses from the bush burned. Then in Exodus 24:16, when God appeared at Sinai, the glory of the Lord looked like, quote, a consuming fire, unquote. 2 Chronicles 5:13 and 14 tells us that when Solomon's temple was dedicated, God came down and the priests couldn't enter the temple because of the brightness of his glory. Ezekiel 28:4 declares that before his fall, Lucifer walked among the fiery stones of God's presence. 2 Thessalonians 1 declares that the brightness of Christ's coming annihilates the wicked. 1 Timothy 6:16 describes God as living in unapproachable light. Hebrews 12:29 announces that our God is a consuming fire. And in Revelation 21:23, we learn that in the new heaven and new earth, we will have no need for the sun and moon to light the earth because God's presence will be its light. What does all this mean? Satan's great fraud, the one that the vast majority of Christians have accepted, is that the place you don't want to go and the place you don't want to be is the place of eternal burnings and consuming fire. But that place is God's very presence. The righteous bask in God's glory, but it is destructive to the wicked. God's life-giving glory consumes all who are out of harmony with him, but heals all who are in harmony. His life-giving glory will transform the righteous as it did Moses when he was on the mountain in God's presence. When Moses came down from Sinai, he radiated God's glory so much that the Israelites begged him to wear a veil because they couldn't bear to look at him. Exodus 34:35. Christ demonstrated the same reality just prior to his crucifixion. On his way to the cross, Jesus revealed that the fire is not what destroys. He walked through the consuming fire and eternal burning at the Mount of Transfiguration. There, God's fiery glory enveloped Christ. And what happened? Did the fire burn Christ? Was he hurt? No. Because Christ was without sin, the fire was harmless. Christ revealed that the fire is not destructive. It is sin that destroys. It is sin that annihilates the sinner. The truth presented in Scripture is simple. God gives all free will. If we choose to reject his methods, we slowly destroy our ability to reason, blind our conscience, and lose the ability to govern ourselves. We come to prefer methods of selfishness, force, exploitation, deceit, and secrecy instead of those of truth, love, openness, and freedom. In the process, we take ourselves so out of harmony with God that his presence becomes a consuming fire. But those who have cooperated with him for the restoration of his image within, operating again from principles of love, truth, openness, and freedom, are transformed by his presence and will live forever in his life-giving glory, the eternal burnings and consuming fire.
Well, there's much more to come, and we'll pick up right where we left off on our next broadcast. Be sure to tune in as Dr. Jennings continues to read from his book, Could It Be This Simple? A Biblical Model for Healing the Mind. In the meantime, check out commonreason.com. Lots of learning resources waiting for you there. Books and blogs and videos and articles and lots of material to help you on your journey of discovery as you learn who God is and how God acts. That's at commonreason.com. This program is sponsored by Come and Reason Ministries. Until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Dr. Tim Jennings wishing you God's presence in your life. Goodbye, everyone. Thank you for spending time with us today. To continue the journey, I urge you to visit comeandreason.com. Here you'll find many excellent resources to help you gain a deeper understanding of the God we all love and serve. That's at comeandreason.com. This is Charles Mills, along with Dr. Tim Jennings, inviting you to join us the next time we come and reason together.